This is Viewpoint with attorney and author Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is a one-hour talk show confronting the issues of America's heart and home. And now with today's edition of Viewpoint, here is Chuck Crismeyer.
Is the Temple Mount God's time bomb? Today we're going to look at the power of possession. It has been said in our law, any lawyer knows this, that possession is 9/10 of the law. Well, that's the phrase anyway. You might disagree with that, saying, well, no, the law supersedes possession. But it depends on, well, power seems to be accorded through possession. And so when you look at the history of the Temple Mount, when you look at the history of Israel and Jerusalem, you have to consider this idea that possession is 9/10 of the law. And if that be true, then how is it that the law has changed so much, because possession has changed so much of the Temple Mount and of Jerusalem over the years? And where does it stand now with regard, for instance, to issues like Gaza or Judea and Samaria or the Golan Heights or southern Lebanon, all of which are part, from God's perspective, of the land, Eretz Israel, dedicated, deeded by God to the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? You see, there's a whole lot more that's involved here than oftentimes we see, because so much of what is talked about is based upon recent history. Not all of history, but recent history. And almost none of it includes God's history. And all history is really his history, isn't it? And so today on Viewpoint, we're going to weave it together, take a look at where all of this stands. Before we get into looking at the Temple Mount in particular, an article came out in the Jerusalem Post last week, All or Nothing, Why Israel Should Stand Firm, Avoid Phased Hostage Deals. It's an editorial that Israel shall no longer play Hamas's game of drips and drabs. The demand is simple, moral, and unshakable. All the hostages at once or nothing. Now, what are the implications of this? The implications are Hamas is not going to deliver all of the hostages, has no intention to do so, and as Donald Trump said last week, he hardly believes that even 20 of them are still alive. So for nearly 2 years, Israel has endured the unbearable reality of its sons and daughters held underground in Gaza. Families of those kidnapped on October 7th have lived in a torment without end, unsure whether their loved ones will ever return. But now, there is a shift. The shift is not toward the release of the hostages. The shift is toward just taking over Gaza. Forget about hostage deals. They're not working anyway. All that is bartering what God has already deeded. God already deeded as an eternal leasehold Gaza, Judea and Samaria, the Golan Heights, southern Samaria, southern Lebanon. All of these areas God already deeded to the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not the descendants of Abraham and Ishmael. You can read about that, the argument that Abraham had with God concerning that in Genesis chapter 17. And God says, no, it's not going to be through Ishmael. The promise is going to be through Isaac, for in Isaac has your seed been called. The promise is fixed in Isaac. And that's when Abraham was told to take Isaac, his son of promise, to a place called Mount Moriah and sacrifice him there when he was a teenager. He said, okay, Lord. As painful as it was, he believed that somehow God was able to resurrect him from the dead if necessary in order to fulfill his promise. And God imputed all of that to Abraham for righteousness. So Abraham takes his son to Mount Moriah, now called the Temple Mount, and he goes through what is necessary to sacrifice his son, and God provides at the very ultimate moment of time, a lamb or a ram as a sacrifice instead of Isaac's son. Because of that, God said, now I am free to provide my only son, Yeshua, Jesus Christ, as the ultimate sacrifice for sin. It all goes back to the Temple Mount. It all goes back to Mount Moriah. So who's in possession of that? Who actually has possession? Well, it depends on what you mean. I guess by possession, from a legal standpoint, Israel should have possession because God deeded it all to the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. From a practical aspect, that possession has changed many, many times. So the reality is, when we talk about Gaza, what we're really talking about is a much bigger picture. We're really talking about who owns the land. Is it owned by those who are occupying it? Is it owned by those who claim current possession? Or is it owned by virtue of what God has already said or deeded there in the book of Genesis, chapter 12, 15, and 18? So, Netanyahu says that Hamas is under tremendous pressure, and he has ordered, though, that Gaza be reclaimed now for Israel. Gaza is probably 70% destroyed, and now Gaza City is under siege by Israel, ready to be fully taken, as a symbol of overtaking all of Gaza. But if you think Gaza is the prize, you are radically mistaken. The real prize is the Temple Mount. And possession of that most prominent square mile, 17 acres on our planet, both past and present, is going to afford some perspective on the historical problem of the Temple Mount. While the devil may be in the details, we're going to take a brief overview here on Viewpoint today. It might be somewhat surprising. So I welcome you to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Chrismeyer. It's conversation with ever-increasing conviction, talk that transforms. Talk that transforms. You say, well, how in the world could things related to the Temple Mount be transforming for me? Well, it depends on your viewpoint. You see, if you really believe that God has spoken, and when God has spoken, the rest of us should all take heed, then it should be transforming in the sense that it should encourage us to put our full confidence, our full trust in God, notwithstanding what seems to be happening on the ground. God has an unusual way of taking what seems to be happening on the ground and turning it into the fulfillment of his purposes, his declaration, the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and his glory. Stay tuned, friends. Lots on the line here today on Viewpoint. And as always, Viewpoint determines destiny. We'll be right back.
Once upon a time, children could pray and read their Bibles in school. Divorces were practically unknown, as was child abuse. In our once great America, virginity and chastity were popular virtues, and homosexuality was an abomination.
So what happened in just one generation?
Hi, I'm Chuck Chrismeyer, and I urge you to join me daily on Viewpoint, where we discuss the most challenging issues touching our hearts and homes. Could America's moral slide relate to the Fourth Commandment?
Listen to Viewpoint on this radio station or anytime at saveus.org.
The song of yesteryear says, on a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, the emblem of suffering and shame. And I love that dear cross. Why? Well, that's where we receive the opportunity, the promise, the hope of salvation. It has to do with the Temple Mount. It has to do with a place where God called Abraham to sacrifice his only, his son of promise, Isaac, at a crucial moment in his life. And because Abraham was faithful and trusted God to the nth degree, God then said, now, because you were willing on earth to sacrifice your only son, I now will be free from heaven to do so through my only son. You say, well, I don't quite understand that. Well, if you were to go to Psalm 8, you might understand it better. David, the psalmist, said, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who has set thy glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemies, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have ordained, what is man? What is man that you've ordained him? And the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him, here's the key, you have made him, man, a little lower than Elohim, the angels, and have crowned him with glory and honor. You have put all things under his, that is, man's feet. David was affirming that which God had already done. He gave responsibility there in Genesis chapter 1 to Adam and his progeny, children, grandchildren, and so on. God created heaven and earth, and he gave dominion to humankind in the earth, over everything on the earth, and was to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. So that being the case, God, having already decreed that he had given dominion in the earth to humankind, to mankind, now what is he going to do since mankind botched it all up with sin, rebellion, right in the very beginning, Adam and Eve? Well, he had a plan. And ultimately, he would offer his only son, but his only son was divine. Yeshua, Jesus, living in the heavens, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one God, three persons in one, and it was divine. So in order for God to bring about the fullness of salvation in accordance with his own word that he had said he had given dominion to man in the earth, Jesus had to come as a man, as a human person, out of a woman's womb on the earth, in order to give God the true legal opportunity to bring salvation to humankind. And it was that man, the God-man, Jesus, Yeshua, full of grace and truth. If you see me, you see the Father, he said, because I and the Father are one. And God sent him to be sacrificed in place of you and me, because we were all under a death penalty. We had all sinned to come short of the glory of God. We failed just like Adam and Eve. And so, in the fullness of time, God sent forth his only begotten Son to deliver them who, up to that time, were all their lives subject to bondage and a death sentence. And it all has to do with the Temple Mount. But that isn't the rest of the story. The rest of the story is what happens with regard to that Temple Mount and why. So when we talk about possession, when we talk about possession of the land, Eretz Israel, when we talk about possession of Jerusalem, when we talk that God called to put his name there, God said, I have chosen Jerusalem to put my name there. I have chosen the Temple Mount to put my name there. Well, when God has chosen something, he's chosen it. He's God. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what Donald Trump says. It doesn't matter what Vladimir Putin says. It doesn't matter what Khomeini in Iran says, it doesn't matter what anybody else says. It doesn't matter what all the collective presidents and prime ministers of the EU say. It doesn't matter what the UN says. They may think it matters, but ultimately it doesn't matter because God has already decreed it. How do we know that? Well, if we go back to Psalm 2, why did Nathan's rage and the people imagine a vain and foolish thing? The kings of the earth gathered together against the Lord and against his anointed Israel, saying, let's tear their bands asunder. But God says, I'm going to have them in derision. They think they're so smart. They think they're so cool. They think they're so powerful. They think they've got the world under control. But it ain't true. God says, I'm going to have them in derision, and he laughs at them. You ought to read Psalm 2. It's fascinating, and it's not very long. And then God says this, regardless of what they say, I have already set my king upon my holy hill. Now, what is his holy hill? His holy hill is the Temple Mount, the place where he chose to put his name there, the place where he sacrificed his only son to give us hope, because no human being who was deeply invested with the sin of Adam through the deceit of Satan, who had taken dominion in the earth, no human being could bring deliverance or salvation. Only one, a man born in the earth who was not tainted with the sin of Adam. So as with one man, sin came unto the earth and man died, that is Adam, even so through Christ, another man shall all be made alive. That's what the Apostle Paul wrote about. So we're tying together a whole lot of things here very, very quickly to set the bigger stage for this issue of the Temple Mount and is it God's time bomb? So, there are at least four religions known to have used the Temple Mount: Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Roman paganism. Yet, preceding all of those was God's covenant with Abraham that was to be established through Isaac, to be confirmed in Jacob, whose name was changed by God to Israel. So regardless of all the historically recorded uses and occupations of the Temple Mount, the mount and all of the surrounding land was deeded by God through an immutable, that is, unchangeable covenant to Abraham and his seed through God's chosen son of promise, Isaac. So the hill that we now identify as the Temple Mount is actually believed to have been inhabited since perhaps the 4th millennium B.C., 4,000 years before Christ. The southern section of that is called Mount Zion. That's where David chose to place his home. And it's all identified with a place called Mount Moriah, where Abraham offered his son. Now, the interesting thing is, according to the Bible, Mount Moriah became a threshing floor owned by a guy by the name of Araunah. And David had sinned terribly against God by numbering the armies of Israel, which was a demonstration that he didn't trust God. I'm going to number the armies of Israel, see if I have enough to wage war and to do what I need to do. So God says, okay, you're in big trouble. I am going to discipline you, David, and I'm going to give you some choices as to how you want to be disciplined. And David said, well, I don't want to be free for the armies of the surrounding nations to come in and attack me. And because they are ruthless, so I'm going to fall on God's mercy. So God sent an angel of destruction, to bring judgment on Israel. The soldiers of Israel, and David lost 70,000 Israelites, his chosen soldiers, as a result of God's judgment because of David's lack of trust. So what is David going to do? Now he's in deep trouble. Deep, deep trouble. So he went to stop the plague of judgment up to Mount Moriah that is now owned by Araunah, a threshing floor, and he bought it for 50 pieces of silver. He bought it. The Muslims didn't buy it. The Palestinians didn't buy it. There were none. The Iranians didn't buy it. Nobody else bought it. David bought it. The one that God had said would ultimately, that through him, would ultimately rule upon the throne of David. Who was that? Jesus, Yeshua, would rule upon the throne of David. So David bought the Temple Mount, and he built an altar there and established plans for building the first temple right there on that very site to replace the traveling tabernacle of God's presence that Moses had built by God's command there in the wilderness coming out of Egypt. So that gives a very quick understanding of how that Temple Mount, and actually the word of the Lord came to Nathan the prophet that had brought judgment upon David and says, now your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. Why? God saw something in David that he didn't see in anyone else. A man after his own heart. So he says, unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order and to establish. So you see, the Temple Mount all comes back to David and the throne of David. And Yeshua, Jesus Christ, ultimately, notwithstanding anything else that's going on in the world, notwithstanding 3,000 years of history since that time, God already, from his viewpoint, has said, my king will rule, the son of David, Jesus, will rule upon the throne of David on the Temple Mount. The Jewish people said, we'll not have this king to reign over us. Ah, but he will. So you see, the encouraging thing about this, and what we need to glean from this, is not the information. The information is for a purpose. Yes, it's for the purpose of understanding our salvation, but also for the purpose of understanding what God expects of us, like what he expected of David. He expected David to trust him, to take him at his word. David failed with regard to the numbering of the people. He was judged accordingly. In fact, David said, judge me according to the integrity of my heart. So God did. There were consequences. There are consequences when you and I fail to trust God. Whether we think so or not, there are consequences. Some of them are worse than others. David experienced horrific consequences for two failures in his life. God didn't let him off the hook. Won't let you off the hook either, any of us. So he wants us to trust him, to take him at his word. Now, we take a look at the rest of the story with regard to the Temple Mount. It's pretty fascinating. And now that we know, God is wanting us to trust him, just as Abraham did, just as David did. And now he says, Jesus is coming from the throne of David and the faith of Abraham. And now He wants to ride upon our faith, too.
There is so much more about Chuck Crismeyer and Save America Ministries on our website, saveus.org. For example, under the marriage section, God has marriage on his mind. Chuck has some great resources to strengthen your marriage. First off, a fact sheet on the state of the marital union, a fact sheet on the state of ministry, marriage, and morals. SaveUS.org. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. What does the Bible really teach about this? Find all of this at SaveUS.org. Also, a letter to pastors, the Hosea Project, SaveUS.org, and many more resources to strengthen your marriage. It's all on Chuck's website, SaveUS.org. Again, you can listen to Chuck's Viewpoint broadcast live and archived. Save America Ministries website at SaveUS.org.
Welcome back to Viewpoint. We're taking a look at the power of possession, possession being nine-tenths of the law. At least that's a phrase that is used in a pragmatic sense within American jurisprudence, because if you don't have possession, well, what do you have? You might have a deed, but what are you going to do with it all? And so our whole legal system with regard to property is set up so that there is not going to be an eternity of ownership unless you're in possession. Now, we don't have time to go into all the nuances of that, but it's necessary to take possession of property that you claim to own. Now, Israel did have possession of the Temple Mount, but then they were sent away to Babylon for 70 years. The Babylonians came in and they destroyed the temple. Then the people were transferred under the kingdom of Cyrus the Great, the Persians, because the Babylonians were judged by the Persians. God judged the Babylonians because they had judged Israel. Remember what God said to Abraham? I will bless those that bless you and curse those that curse you. You remember that? God keeps his word. He did that with regard to Babylon, and he's doing it again with regard to Persia, which now is called Iran. But there was a Persian king that God blessed in particular. Nearly 500 years after Israel had exercised the exclusive possession over the Temple Mount, the centerpiece of their culture, of their lives. This Persian king is called Cyrus. Cyrus was God's anointed. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held to subdue nations before him. I will go before you and make the crooked places straight for Jacob my servant's sake and Israel my elect. And I have called you by your name. I have surnamed you, though you have not known me. Isaiah chapter 45, verses 1 to 6. Fascinating. So here lies one of the conundrums of history. A great Persian king is used by the God of Jacob, Israel, to rebuild the temple and to restore Israel her God-deeded homeland. It was the king's favor and grace toward God's elect that caused him to be described by God as anointed. Language that clearly identified him from God's viewpoint as, shall we say, a type of Israel's Messiah. It's interesting. If we follow this, it's fascinating to see how God worked. So, is it not fascinating that after Donald Trump had been elected the first time, the way he treated Israel was seen from the Jewish viewpoint as akin to Cyrus the Great. And so they began to create coins in Israel. I have some of them, where the image of Donald Trump is superimposed upon the image of Cyrus the Great on these coins. Now, how far is that going to go? in this term for Donald J. Trump? I don't know. But just as Cyrus had been a type of the Messiah for Christ to come, so Antiochus, or Antiochus, was a type of the Antichrist who came under the Greeks, declaring himself God in a rebuilt temple on that very mount, the Temple Mount. And then Rome came in and took dominion. And they changed the name of the city to Aelia Capitolina, built in 130 BC by the Emperor Hadrian at the site of Jerusalem. The whole thing continued. And then we're going to see now where it went from there, where it's going now, and why you and I can trust the Lord to do what otherwise it seems impossible to have happen. God is the God of the impossible. He makes possible the impossible, and when he has spoken, the high mountains tremble. There's a song, used to sing it. When God speaks, the high mountains tremble. My mother used to almost command me to sing that song. It's a solo song I used to sing quite a bit, especially when my voice was more of a second tenor area, and it has slipped down into the baritone arena, basso baritone for radio broadcasting. It's interesting what God has done with my voice. Even people have acknowledged it from coast to coast. But in any event, before we go further, I want to make available to you my book, King of the Mountain. It's probably one of the second or third best-selling book of the 11 that I have written, King of the Mountain, the eternal epic end-time battle. For it said that he who rules the Temple Mount rules the world. It is a $20 book, yours for $15 on our website, saveus.org. You can call us at 1-800-SAVE-USA, 1-800-SAVE-USA, or write to us at Save America Ministries. P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Writing a check at $6 for postage and handling. I can almost guarantee you're not going to be disappointed. You're going to be informed, but through the information, the vast information, you are going to be transformed. You are going to come to a place where you know that God is in control, not just theoretically. You'll come to a deeper sense that God is in control. He is going to keep his word no matter what's going on out there, no matter what prime ministers and presidents of the world say, no matter what the UN says, no matter what the EU says, no matter what Vladimir Putin says, no matter what Xi Jinping says, no matter what a president of the United States says, God is going to keep his word. He's not a man that he should lie. And as you read this book, you're going to be stirred greatly. You're going to see how the nations of the earth have come against God and against his anointed, seeking to become king of the mountain. And the battle is raging and going to continue even now. Increasingly, the game, the looming battle, in fact, one of the last chapters in the book is called The Looming Battle. The mystery of the mountain. The mystery of the mountain must be discerned if we're to unravel the mystery of history. The confluence of history and prophecy are coming together so that history and prophecy are becoming congruent, so that you can't distinguish one from the other. Going back to my study in geometry, those of you who've had geometry know that word congruent. So, get a copy of the book, The Eternal Epic End Time Battle. It's called King of the Mountain. Some people would say, oh, King of the Hill. Well, yes, God calls it his holy hill, and he calls it his holy mountain, both. Both and. You played a childhood game, undoubtedly. King of the mountain or king of the hill, where a few kids would get together on a grass hill or gravel or whatever. It didn't have to be much. And somebody would get up on top and declare themselves to be king. And then the friends would come along and try to pull him down so they could be king. One day, the Lord showed me that that's the exact sample, emblem, metaphor for what is happening in history and what is going to happen in the final days of human history, the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, the battle for King of the Mountain. With that understanding, it should be very simple then. As you begin to read the book, you'll see, oh my goodness, that's exactly what we did as a kid. And now all the nations of the earth are playing the same game. But it's for keeps. It's a dangerous game. But they're playing it anyway. They're actually daring God to do what he has declared to do. And Satan himself intends to rule and reign from that Temple Mount, doesn't he? Isn't that what the Apostle Paul said? That the Antichrist will, upon identifying himself as the Antichrist, he's going to come in and people are going to think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. He's going to be priest on earth, good builder, men. He's going to be seen as the great peacemaker. He's going to be seen as the wonder man of the world. And then after about 3 years of that, he'll walk into a rebuilt temple. Perhaps he'll even help the temple to be rebuilt. And then he will declare himself God on behalf of Satan himself. He's called the Antichrist, the personification of the beast and the beast empire. So, now you have the bigger picture. You got to get a copy of the book because it's going to open your eyes to the whole trajectory of history going all the way back to the Mount of God in the heavens before the creation of the earth. That's where it began, where Satan himself said, I will ascend to the heights of the north. I will be like the Most High. Will he ascend to the heights of the north in your life and become king of the mountain of your heart? That question remains to be answered, and it can't be answered theoretically. So when we get back, we're going to take a look at a fascinating piece of history starting in around 610 AD that will bring us up to the current time. We'll be right back.
Have you ever considered what the early church was like? Many people are developing a heart longing for greater fulfillment in our practices as Christians. A recent study showed 53,000 people a week are leaving the back door of America's churches in frustration. What is going on? Why has there not been even a 1% gain among followers of Christ in the last 25 years? Could it be that God is seeking to restore first century Christianity for the 21st century? Jesus said, I'll build my church. Is Christ by his Spirit stirring to prepare the church for the 21st century? The early church prayed together and broke bread from house to house. They were family, and it was said by all who observed, behold how they love one another. Incredible.
But the same can be found right now. Go to saveus.org and click Sell Church. We can revive first century Christianity for the 21st century.
It's about people, not programs. It's about a body, not a building.
That's saveus.org. Click Sell Church.
By 323 AD, Gentile believers in Jesus Christ had become of such influence throughout Rome that the culture began to be strongly affected. And it created powerful tensions, Pervasive paganism of Rome culture came into conflict with Christians who refused to bow to pagan shrines and to the emperor who claimed to be divine. And then we had the Crusades that began to take a look at the Temple Mount after that. Well, why did they take a look at the Temple Mount around 1000 to 1100 AD? Well, it's because another people group, religious group, took over the Temple Mount. They took it from the Byzantine Empire, that is the Temple Mount, where there had been a church built on the Temple Mount. That church was destroyed, and on its ruins, the Dome of the Rock was built. So when we're looking at history, when you distill it all, like we're trying to do here on Viewpoint today, it makes clear that the battle for King of the Mountain is indeed epic. It's eternal, it's epic, and it's the end time battle. It's moving in that direction, and we're nearly there in the final battle for rulership and possession of the Temple Mount. In 610 AD, the Sassanid Empire, that is the last great Persian empire before Muslim conquest and the adoption of Islam, drove the Byzantine Empire out of the Middle East. That gave the Jews possession of Jerusalem for the first time in centuries. They soon resumed animal sacrifice on the Mount for the first time since the Second Temple. The Byzantines retook the area about 5 years later. But just before that took place, the Persians gave control to the Christians, who tore down the partially built temple and turned it into a garbage dump. And then came the Muslims. So you can see why the Jewish people might not have all that much favor toward Christians when Christians tore down the temple that they were building, turned it into a garbage dump. Then came the Muslims. Sometime in the decade of 630 AD, the Muslim Caliph Omar took the city of Jerusalem, captured it, and then headed immediately to the Temple Mount in order to find the holy site of what he called the furthest mosque, which was mentioned in the Quran and in the Hadith as being in Jerusalem. In 691 AD, the Caliph Abd al-Malik constructed an octagonal Islamic building topped by a dome. The shrine became known as the Dome of the Rock and was later covered in gold in 1920. The term of al-Haram al-Sharif, or Noble Sanctuary, describes the entire surrounding area of the rock central to the Temple Mount. For Muslims, the significance of both the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque makes Jerusalem the third most holy city after Mecca and Medina. So, when you look at Jerusalem and you look at the pictures, the one thing that always stands out is the Dome of the Rock. And it's on the Temple Mount, the 17 acres, as is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is largely underground. Then, a Jewish synagogue was built on the Temple Mount during a period of apparently favorable relations between the Islamic rulers and the Jewish subjects, but that structure was later destroyed by the Crusaders, who in 1099 AD conquered the city, massacring both Jews and Muslims, curiously, you might say falsely, in the name of Christ under Pope Urban II. Who was called the Vicar of Christ. So they were pursuing dominion of the Temple Mount. So the Dome of the Rock at that time was turned to a place of Christian worship and renamed Templum Domini, meaning the Temple of the Lord. The Al-Aqsa Mosque became a palace for Crusader kings and later headquarters of the Knights Templar. After nearly a century of Christian rule, the Muslim Sultan Saladin laid siege to Jerusalem, defeated the Crusaders in 1187 AD, tore down the cross, replacing it with the Islamic crescent, and the rest is history. So, who has possession? Well, in reality, Israel supposedly had possession, but then the possession was given up. Then the epic eternal quest for dominion of the Temple Mount was not restricted to nation versus nation or to religion versus religion. It was a prize that seemed to draw all comers, whether individually or collectively. So when the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish conquest of Palestine, took place in 1516 AD under Suleiman the Magnificent, Ottoman authorities continued prohibiting non-Muslims from setting foot on the Temple Mount. Thus, the Muslim Turks gained dominion over the world's ultimate prize, claiming absolute dominion over the Temple Mount for 400 years, forbidding the rest of the Muslim world while preserving Islamic authority until the end of World War I. Now, in 1948, Israel became a nation. The Muslims tried to force her out, told the Arab and Muslim people that were in Israel to flee, and they were going to push Israel into the sea, and then they'd be able to take over the Muslims and Arabs would take over the whole land, but it never happened because the Muslim nations, the Arab nations, lost the battle. So the very people that they had promised were going to take over the land, they put in camps, refugee camps. We now know them as the Palestinians. They now occupy places like Gaza, Gaza Strip, and Judea and Samaria. That's where the battle lies there. But the Temple Mount is the premier focus. So, when Israel regained Jerusalem in 1967, a great battle, historic and prophetic battle, Moshe Dayan, the bold and brash Israeli general who was basically a pagan, gave administrative control of the Temple Mount to the Islamic Waqf, granting the Muslim world the power of possession, leaving only formal or technical authority in the hands of Israel. And that's where the battle remains today. The Muslim world, the Islamic Waqf, prohibits Jews and Christians from ascending the Temple Mount. More and more Christians and Jews are ascending the Temple Mount, but in small numbers. They're prohibited from praying on the Temple Mount. In other words, possession is still 9/10 of the law. So what's going to happen? Well, there's going to be a rebuilt temple. There is going to be a rebuilt temple because God said so. There's only one way for Satan's Antichrist figure to walk into the temple and declare himself God, as the Apostle Paul tells us in the book of Thessalonians. It is going to be rebuilt. The Lord himself, said the prophet Malachi, will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom he delighted. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord. But who shall abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appears? For he is going to be like a refiner's fire. That's Jesus, my friends. So in the meantime, the prophet Joel, with inspiration of the Holy Spirit, says, proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Beat your plowshares into swords. Multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The Lord's going to roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the earth will shake. But the Lord will be the hope of his people, the strength of the children of Israel, said the prophet Joel. For the Lord is our defense, and the Holy One of Israel is our king. So take heed to yourselves, you rulers who deign to lift up the sword against the Lord and against his anointed. Do you imagine yourselves any match for God? The Lord shall be king over all the earth in that day. There shall be one Lord, and his name one, says Zechariah. Indeed, the Temple Mount looms as God's time bomb, ready now to explode, engulfing the world in unprecedented war. Will a rebuilt temple be the fuse? The epic, eternal, and end-time battle lies ahead, my friends. It does, as does the time of Jacob's trouble, related directly to the temple. You might want to get a copy of the book King of the Mountain, because it covers not only this, but vast amounts of both history and prophecy, tying it all together with a nice little ribbon, and you can see how the whole picture is coming together, has been coming together, and now is going to come together in its finality shortly. It's a $20 book, yours for $15. Don't miss it. The eternal, epic, end-time battle for King of the Mountain. Go to the website, saveus.org. Give us a call, 1-800-SAVE-USA. 1-800-SAVE-USA. Or write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Writing a check at $6 for postage and handling. Now, I want to just briefly urge you. It is very possible that you've been listening to this program now for weeks, months, maybe even years, and you've never seen fit to help support the program. Have you noticed we do not have commercial support? There's a reason for that. We don't seek it, because the moment you do that is the moment you give them control over what you say or don't say. And once you build up, for instance, a good support system through commercial support, and then somebody who's a major donor or supporter decides they don't like what you say, then all of a sudden you're in big, big trouble. Big trouble. And the temptation is always to conform what you say or don't say to those who hold the purse strings. When God says, I'll support your need, he relies upon his people. He doesn't have a heavenly counterfeit machine. No, he trusts his people to support what he does, what he's doing. So if you believe that this program, as you've been listening for some period of time, is consistent with what God is doing and saying, and wanting to encourage, to strengthen, to disciple, to build up, to woo, to warn, all of these things, to transform, then I urge you to seriously consider becoming a partner. You can do that by setting up, going to the website, saveus.org, and set up a what we call an automated gift, where every month you tell us what you want deducted from your credit card. You can change it by just making a phone call. Either delete it, reduce it, increase it, whatever. Or write a generous check once, a large check, or monthly, another check that God would put on your heart. Look, things are getting tougher and tougher. The need for this program is increasing. That's why we've devoted 30 years receiving no payment in return. God bless. It'd be a blessing.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Chrismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.